Welcome to the Tipsy Archives. This is Rachel Leagy. I was going to post an episode this week, but school and exams got in the way, so it didn't happen. But instead, I have something a little bit different. I dug into the vault and I found the first interview that I ever did when I bought my first microphone. It's about 2 years old, and it is an interview with my mother, Sarah McDonald. And she is an artist, a maker, and one of the most creative, determined, and intelligent people that I know. And we talked about some of her experiences, her artistic process, her experiences in art school, as well as her research and work with artists with developmental disabilities. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview with my mom, Sarah McDonald.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Rach.
Obviously I know a lot about your life as an artist and as a student, but there's a lot of stuff that I've never necessarily had the chance to ask you about.
Okay.
And being that I'm now in school, I definitely have some interest in hearing what you have to say. So, I've always done art, and I've always felt really encouraged by my family. And it's interesting because when sometimes I'm in school in the art program, I do run into those people who say, oh, my parents don't want me to be doing art, or they would rather I be in the business program. And I always have that thought of like, wow, like I've never had that. I feel pretty lucky that you guys have always been really supportive of me being an artist and being artistic. And one of the reasons is because obviously you're an artist. So one thing I wanted to ask you about was when you decided to basically quit your job and go back to art school when we were kids. And I mean, how old would I have been when that happened? When did that happen?
I would say that would have been about 94.
Okay, so I was...
10. Around 10.
I thought I was older than that.
11.
Okay, so in my mind...
I went back in 95 to school.
Yeah, in my mind it was just, it all happened very quickly and you said, I quit my job, I'm going to school, and that was it. And I, at the time, didn't really know why that had happened.
Or, yeah.
So what led you to go to art school in your... Or what, early 40s or late 30s?
I would have been about exactly 40, around 40.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds kind of cheesy, but I went to a personal development weekend thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of that and what went on there and listening to other people and all kinds of things, I just had a realization that I did not want to do what I was working at for the rest of my life.
Which was designing kitchens.
Kitchen designer. And I like kitchens. Mm-hmm. I like that. But a lot of it felt like people, helping people buy stuff that they didn't always need. And it felt very materialistic to me, which maybe it's not fair to say that, but that's what it felt like to me. It didn't feel very meaningful. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm not saying it's not meaningful work, but for me at that time, it did not feel that way.
You wanted more.
I just knew that that's not what I wanted my whole working life to be.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the technical skills you got from drawing kitchens helped you when you did go into art, like drawing classes?
Well, I believe everything you've done in your life informs your art practice. Even if you're consciously rejecting something, it's still informing your practice in that way, but... Yeah, specifically the drafting, because at that time, that was before this kind of work was done on CAD or computers like it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the reasons I liked it so much, is because I really enjoyed the drawing up the kitchens and then doing sketches and doing all that. And I did take a two-year interior design program after high school, which involved a lot of drafting as well. And I know, especially looking back... that the drafting in particular really did influence my work, and also the education in design, which is different than what you get in a fine arts program. You don't necessarily get education about design because mm-hmm. that's more of a commercial kind
did
of
you
thing.
Not take a design class in fine arts?
Not design especially, no.
Oh, because we did take in first year a design class that went over composition, color theory.
Well, they would, they didn't call it design.
Hmm.
Design typically is more oriented to something commercial like interior design or graphic design or something like that. It's a bit of a blurry area, but there's a lot of different theories and so on about design. You get furniture design and all fashion and all that. It's a little bit of a different slant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So well, certainly that did inform.
I certainly do remember even growing up that you were always doing or making things, you know, whether it was our clothes or helping us with our school projects or I remember, and I don't remember what it was for, but I have this memory of you making these large Narnia posters. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What was that for?
That was your elementary school in West Kelowna, West Bank.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something volunteer in school, and I noticed they had some walls in the library, and I just asked if they'd like it if I made some posters for them. So I did the Chronicles of Narnia, and then I think I might have also done Beatrix Potter or something like that.
That sounds about right.
It was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that you went back to school right at about 40, because I went back to school at 30, and my experience with that so far has been really good in that I feel a lot more focused and motivated and I guess more confidence compared to if I had been in school at 20. So, and then also dealing with, it's interesting to deal with everyone who's so much younger than me. But your experiences at 40 must have been even just amplified to that.
Well, the younger student thing for sure, because some of them were, of course, coming out of high school. So I mean, technically I was old enough to be their mother. I mean, I'll be a young mother. But although I have to say, I am told I often look younger than my age. So maybe they didn't think I was 40.
Well, a lot of students are surprised when I tell them I'm in my 30s because they go, oh, I thought you were 25.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
But I found for the first 2 years, anyways, that I was quite invisible. I tended to, the mature students tended to hang out together, and it was like to the younger ones, we didn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they thought we were there just having a holiday time, or I'm not sure exactly. And then third year, they start to notice, oh, you're still here. Oh, you actually are doing some work that isn't that bad. And then they start to notice you're actually physically there.
And then by fourth year, is it fourth year you're sharing a studio with a bunch of people, or third?
What we had at that time was we had three studio spaces, so we were in three, grouped into the three spaces. Yeah.
So what was it like having to share a studio space with 20-year-olds?
Well, actually, in my space, all of us but one were so-called mature students.
Oh, well, that was probably better.
Which actually was fine because, yeah, it worked out fine. Actually, the one young student failed.
Oh, yeah. It kind of surprises me sometimes how people can. I guess it's maybe at that age you haven't learned very good time management, because sometimes they say, "How are you failing these art classes?" But I think that's just the amount of effort you're putting into it, or the time management, or
well,
or
that
not
was
caring,
the case with
or
this student is they just slept in and didn't do they just didn't do the work, and I mean that's the other difference, big difference, especially mature students that have say kids at home, is that you only have so much time to get to do class and then get the work done. Like so, there's you can't fool around. Like you just can't if you want to get the work done, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be really time effective and organized and productive, and that's probably the biggest thing that set the mature students apart from the younger ones.
Yeah, because you had four kids at home.
I had four kids at home.
So I was about 10, 11, so Elizabeth would have been quite young.
Elizabeth was about four, and the boys were
15, 17, no, 13 and 15 maybe.
Something like that.
Yeah. But I think also with you being in school and Dad working, it kind of forced us older kids to help out more. Because I do remember us, you know, they're being encouraged to help out with dinners. And when we got a little bit older, we would take
being things, encouraged?
Well, or being told to. Having to feed ourselves because, you know, everybody was quite busy. So, I mean, I can't imagine how I find school tiring, and I'm a part-time student and I work, but I don't have any children, so it must have been quite tiring. But did you find, being a mature student, that it was easier to connect with your profs?
Possibly. I think some of the profs, but there always are some profs, I don't know if it's just fine arts, but who like hanging out with the younger students because I think they are the same age.
Oh.
And they're kind of into that. And they, especially, it can be kind of still a macho environment, is what I found, is that the young guys are the ones who are seen as the up-and-coming artists.
Hmm.
Personally, I think there's a bias there.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look at how many people are in a program and wonder, especially in fine arts, like how many people here are actually going to go on and really do something with art because it's so hard to make it.
Yeah, and it's surprising. Some of the people you think will don't, and then some of the ones that you don't think really would, they do. So it's kind of hard to predict, and I think it depends on media, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how much you're really doing the legwork to market yourself and get yourself out there and get involved, I think, is a huge part of whether or not you're successful in the art world.
But some of them are not in... they're not working in media that's marketable. So say they're in performance art, for instance. So they may still be really successful going on artist residencies or exchanges or something like that. And if they're single and unattached, they have freedom to do a lot of that kind of stuff, which is great.
Okay. So after you did graduate from the bachelor's program, you did a number of shows throughout BC in different galleries over the next following years?
Yeah, I worked really hard. I worked for about 7 years. I had a rented art studio with another artist, and then I worked really hard to get shows in public galleries, like smaller public galleries, for sure. So at that time, that involved sending a lot of slides. Now it's, of course, all digital. But at that time, you had to photograph your work and then put it in slides and tape the slides and label them and blah, blah, blah.
Did you ever get them back or do they just keep that stuff?
I can't really remember. I just know I had a whole bunch of slides left over. And so it costs you money to do all that too.
Yeah.
And then you get the show wherever it is. And a lot of the time, if it's a gallery, not teeny weeny gallery, it's probably a gallery that even has staff. But often they don't have money to pay the Carfac fee.
Which is what?
That's the Canadian Artist Representation Group, and they set the minimum wage schedule. There's no union. It's the closest thing to a union that visual artists have. And they have copyright fees and all kinds of stuff on there. So you can look on there, and according to the size of the gallery and the length of the show and so on, there's a fee that you're supposed recommended to pay you, but
what about the shipping of the artwork? Is that something you pay for or they pay for?
Well, often what would happen was the gallery would pay, this would be typically, they'd say, well, we can't pay a fee, but we'll pay your shipping one way.
So then you have to get it back.
Yeah. Or you would pay to get it there and they would pay to send it back or something like that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you could come and do an artist talk, they would pay you not the Carfac fee for the artist talk, but they pay you something for doing the artist talk. So you certainly didn't make money, and their mandate is not to sell work. So you most likely would not sell work because that's not what a public gallery does.
Right.
If you're lucky, somebody would want to buy a piece and they buy a piece from the community because smaller galleries are a little looser with that. But yeah, so I did, and then the whole idea is to build up your CV, your showing record.
Now that's something I need to do before I start. I have made lists of all the shows I've been in, but I need to make an official CV before I start forgetting dates.
Yeah, it's really important to document all that information. It's also really important to document all your work, right? To have the digital images
of all the stuff that's been in shows.
Oh, all your work, period, because you never know. At some point, you may want... it's just important to have a record of all the work you've done, even if it's not something that went in shows. But the shows that you really want to have on a CV are public galleries. Those are the ones that count the most in terms of art world approval.
Well, I've got one good one. Kelowna Art Gallery.
Right.
So lots of little, small, artist-run independent shows. I've been in lots of that kind of stuff. But
yeah, you just keep building it up.
Yep. So after that, I mean, I don't really know exactly when Cool Art started, but for 10 years you ran a nonprofit group that taught adults with developmental disabilities art classes. And can you just talk a bit about how that came up and when that started?
Well, that's probably a couple years after I finished my BFA and had my studio. And then your brother was just a young adult, became a young adult at that point, and he wanted to do some art stuff in the community. And I realized there really wasn't anything in our town that was, that really worked for him. It was, or worked for people with intellectual disabilities, because the art classes were either too expensive for people on a disability benefits, or the instruction was too complicated. You know, it was
or mostly it was arts and crafts, glue and popsicle,
or there
was
really awful, and really awful arts and crafts.
Yeah,
really horrible.
But not for
plastic coasters and stuff.
Yeah, adults that really wanted to paint or
I have quality arts instruction and quality arts materials. So I got some art teachers and artist friends together and said, do you guys want to just do a few workshops and see what happens? And actually that was 2003. And it's still going. So I was president for 10 years, and for quite a few of those years, I did just about almost everything there. And now they're at the point where they have some staff, and their budget's about $60,000 a year, which isn't huge for a nonprofit, but it's pretty good. And have a permanent space now in the Rotary Arts Center in Kelowna, so it's pretty exciting. And then
I didn't know that. I didn't know they had a space.
Yeah, they do.
Oh, great.
They do. It's great. It's made a big difference.
So was that just you sort of asking your friends,
yeah,
hey, do you want to come teach an art class?
Yeah.
And of course Jordan had all his friends and his, you know,
just getting the word out to people I knew. It's difficult doing that for that population because of confidentiality. There's no list that you can just go down and phone people. It all has to be word of mouth kind of stuff. So It took a while to kind of get the word out there that we were doing it. And it was super cheap. I think it was a toonie when we started. Saturday workshops were one toonie, because I knew that a lot of these people don't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want money to be the reason they didn't come. And even then, sometimes people would come, they didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
But we just fundraised to get materials, and all the teachers volunteered at that time.
So working with these artists must have been a really enlightening experience, and seeing how they create and what they do.
Yeah, it is, because the art world is so intellectual that I was quite interested in their process of creating work, and it really got me interested how do artists who have an intellectual disability of some sort, how do they fit into the art world? Like, do they have any place in the art world? I thought about it a lot, and I looked online, and I would find bits of things here and there, but not a great deal at that time. And I didn't know anything about it, so it was a really steep learning curve for me. And just things like how much direction do you give?
Mm-hmm.
Do you say, oh, the work's done, why don't you stop now? Or do you not say that?
Right.
Or do you say, I think you need to have more contrast in that? Or do you not say that? Like, how, you know, so not knowing how much supervision do you give or not give?
Or how much critique?
How much, yeah.
But so that influenced what you ended up writing your master's thesis on.
Yeah, so then I ended up going back to university because I just thought, you know, this is important. I feel like this is really important, and it feels like a social justice issue and an equity, arts equity issue, and this is something I feel strongly about. And so I talked to some profs, and they had a new interdisciplinary master's program at UBC Okanagan.
So this is something I feel guilty about, because whenever I talk about what you have your master's in, I always blank on what to call it.
Well, a lot of people think I have an MFA,
right,
Master's of Fine Arts, but I don't. It's an MA, Master's of Arts, because it's not about my own studio work, which an MFA would be. It's about looking at the work of... It's actually not even looking at the work of artists with intellectual disabilities. It's looking at their experience and how they fit into the art world, or do they fit into the art world? So just kind of looking at how, putting them in the context of the art world, how does that work? And are they authentic artists, which seems like a really kind of almost insulting and basic question, but I couldn't find any research about it really. And so part of it was showing that yes, they do have an authentic art making experience and are authentic artists. Because one argument is that IQ is tied to creativity, and so therefore somebody with an IQ would have limited creativity, which there's been research done showing that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, when you say that, I immediately think, well, no, I don't agree with that, but I can definitely picture a situation where if you showed, you know, say one of the cool artists' art to somebody and they said, oh, that's great, and then you tell them that it's an adult with developmental disabilities, suddenly their opinion of the art is going to change,
mm-hmm.
you know, what it
mm-hmm.
means or whether
mm-hmm.
or not it's really art. And
yeah.
It's a lot of interesting questions that it brings up.
It does bring up a lot of interesting questions, and I think it really challenges a great deal about what the art world is today, too, because the art world has all these requirements of literacy and education. Artists have to be able to write really fluently and with great literacy about their work and theory about their work and be able to speak about it.
But
it's visual work, so it's,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's an interesting discussion.
But it's not like there's any rules against somebody, you know, having an advocate to help them articulate or speak for them or write for them. Maybe there is.
I don't think there's any rules about it, and it has happened. In the States particularly, there's a few places where it has happened now. I used, for an example, kind of a case study, I used a woman from California. She's dead now, but her work is in the Smithsonian, the MoMA, Brooklyn Museum of Art, all over, and she had Down syndrome. So she definitely had advocates because she was deaf and not very verbal.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a great case study. Obviously, her work is high caliber. It's in Smithsonian as well. Obviously, her work is high caliber. It wouldn't be there, so it kind of wrecks that argument.
Yeah. I mean, and it definitely kind of brings you back to that question that I think, you know, everybody ends up talking about is, you know, what is art? What defines art? And of course, there's no one answer to that.
No.
But it's always an interesting conversation to have. And I think if you look at something and it evokes thoughts and emotions in you, then that's art to me. But yeah, I mean, you could talk about that
mm-hmm.
forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, You stepped down from Cool Arts a while ago.
About 3 years ago.
Kind of like, you know, you thing that you created and then passed it off to people you trusted, and now it's its own.
Yeah, I felt like it, to go to the next stage, it needed to kind of get pushed out of the nest a bit.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'd get involved with it again in the future?
Well, I actually am now. I'm working for them 20 hours a month doing fund development.
Hmm.
So not on the board, but working on contract.
So I know you know you're pretty well versed in, you know, writing for grants and that kind of thing. And did that mostly come out of Cool Arts?
Yeah. And then, of course, I've been working in a research center, so I haven't been writing grants, but I'm fairly familiar with the proposals that are written. So that's sort of another avenue of grant writing that I've been exposed to.
So in the world of art, I mean, aside from Cool Arts, what we've been talking about, do you think that art should be funded by, you know, the government or private? Seems like it has been historically for hundreds of years.
It has been historically, and if you look at some different countries, they're very generous to artists in terms of supporting, even the province of Quebec, unless things have changed recently. I believe it's always been very supportive of its artists, and some European countries as well. Corporate, I don't know as much about. I know there's a lot of corporate competitions and prizes, I think, that are available. Do I think they should? Well, yeah, I because I think the government supporting the arts feeds back, practically speaking, it's proven that it feeds back into the economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a long-term thing. It doesn't happen in a year or before the next election, but
because we've seen a lot of cuts to arts programs in the last few years.
Yeah, yeah.
I speaking personally as an artist, of course I'd love to be funded and just have the freedom to make and not worry too much about paying for it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
Talking a little bit more about your personal artwork, a lot of your work is, I guess you call it more abstract, even though there are representational figures and images in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's lots of layers and collage, textures, colors, shapes.
I'm all about layers.
All about layers. So I find that it's funny when people look at realistic images, paintings of, you know, landscape people, it's easy to say, oh, that's really good, or oh, that's not so good. But when people look at more abstract work, you get a lot more varied reactions, like, you know, oh, what is it?
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
Is it done?
Yeah. Oh, I'll look forward to seeing that when it's finished.
Yeah. It is finished.
It is finished.
Or sometimes people who make suggestions about how you could improve
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. I particularly enjoy people that tell me how much my work has improved.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Or just a lot of, yeah, what does it mean? What is this? But I think, I mean, you put a lot of thought into the work that you do in the planning process, don't you?
Yes and no. My comfort zone would be to plan it all out. So working, I challenge myself not to do that. I'll plan it out somewhat, like the materials, maybe the general composition. But then I'll try to challenge myself to work spontaneously in some ways. Because I think that's when the best work happens, is when you're playing around. And playing around can't happen when it's all planned.
Well, don't you find that even when you're planning the whole thing, it ends up going in a different direction sometimes than you thought it would?
I never plan the whole thing. Now, yeah. Printmaking is a little different sometimes because you kind of have to plan it.
Yeah.
Having said that, when you use the press, unless you're doing an edition, which I don't do anymore, there always is somewhat of a surprise because you can plan it, but you still don't know exactly what's going to happen. So there always is kind of a element of surprise, which is part of the reason why I love printmaking.
Well, and I've just started playing with a little bit of printmaking myself, and I enjoy how even the different prints have those subtle variations,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes mistakes happen, and mm-hmm. half the print goes on super light, but it ends up looking pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of happy accidents, as Bob Ross would call them.
Happy accidents, yes, happy accidents.
Are a really cool part of printmaking, I think.
Yeah.
But it's definitely different. More abstract or more modern art is a very different world, and you get very different reactions than is more traditional classical or representational art.
Yeah. I find that people often, what they respond to is color. That's a very kind of primal thing, I think, the way people respond to color, and it can be tied to all kinds of different memories or feelings. But I often use a lot of found materials in my work, whether they're labels off food or whatever they are, all kinds of stuff. I'm always finding stuff. And sometimes it's that stuff, the found papers or found objects, that trigger people. Like, I used a ViewMaster reel mm-hmm. quite a bit for a while. And sometimes it puzzles people, or they find it humorous, or whatever. And then often I'll get asked, well, why did you put that in there?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is. And I just usually say, well, because I just knew it had to go there. It just felt mm-hmm. right. That's the only reason I can give you.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder with my own art, because I do a lot of similar things that you do, if it's that I just was so subconsciously influenced by your work for years and years, seeing it around the house and seeing you create it for school. Or, I don't know, if we're just similar, or, you know, how much I maybe just osmosis, because I also enjoy collage and layering and found objects and, you know.
Well, I think that happens because my studio mate and I think that happened with us because we were working in each mm-hmm. other's spaces all the time.
Yeah, and I remember when I lived with my friend Heather, who is also an artist, and she always created in mostly black and white ink.
Mm.
And I was doing a lot more color. And when we lived together, we started swapping a bit. My color started to disappear, and she started mm-hmm. to introduce some mm-hmm. color into her work. So
change is good.
Yeah, totally. So speaking of materials, what's one tool or medium that you know you just couldn't do without?
Mm.
What's the invaluable tool for you?
That I couldn't do without. I love gesso.
Yeah.
I love carving around shapes with gesso. I find it very calming.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, also pencil crayon, carving around shapes with a white or...
I like gesso for the opposite reason, because I like very smooth surfaces.
Oh.
So when I'm on a canvas, I want to get rid of that canvas texture.
Oh.
And just have it as smooth as possible.
No, I'm generally mucking up the texture in some way.
Now, other than fine art, which I know you has been a little bit on the back burner for you for a little while with all the other things going on in your life, you do a lot of crafting. Knitting, felting.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is what I tell people. When I used to teach printmaking at Clone Art Gallery, every class would be at least one person that would say, I'm not an artist. I can't do this. And so I always said that artists are people that have to make something with their hands. They have to make something, and it might be food, it might be gardening, it might be knitting. I don't know. It doesn't matter if it's not pencil and paper or canvas and paint. It's that you're a maker. You've got to make things. So that's the... If I'm not working... I found when I worked in the studio, I didn't knit and do things as much.
Mm-hmm.
But now, right now, it's just for different reasons. Haven't had the studio time. I just have to be. I'm either making cards or... knitting or felting or something. I don't know what I'd do if I wasn't making something.
Yeah, if I'm not working on many art projects, I'll then feel like I have time to cross stitch.
I'd go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not very good at just sitting and watching TV. I need to do something with my hands.
While you're watching TV. Yeah.
And catch up on all the good shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who would you say is an artist that you've really loved throughout your life?
Throughout my life.
Because
my taste really changed, I have to say, after I started going to art school. Before that, you know, kind of predictable.
Yeah.
Like the Impressionists.
Yeah.
Boring.
But, you know, it's when you're not terribly educated in art, that kind of artwork, the Impressionists, is you look at it and it's just so enjoyable.
It's appealing.
It's appealing. It's beautiful to everyone.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Mass appeal.
Yeah. And I still like Degas
very
much. I've gone through phases, but as a genre, I love abstract expressionism, and I love Rothko and Cy Twombly, Motherwell.
I went through a Frankenthaler phase pretty recently where I was just really into her work. I mean,
yeah.
I still really like it.
Yeah, and Tapiz, the Spanish artist.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, the microphone is sitting on a book of this artist.
Tapiz.
Yep.
Yeah. And Jim Dine. He's sitting on a Jim Dine book. And I'm a big Jim Dine fan, pop art as well. I love Andy.
Yeah.
I do love Andy Warhol.
Well, and he's such an interesting figure.
So interesting. And when I was in New York, the Guggenheim had a gallery in Soho, I think. And I don't think it's there anymore, but it was a huge... It was a one room building. It was all open, and it was the Andy Warhol Last Supper series silkscreen. These massive prints, and it was magical. Like I felt like I was in the print studio with him. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, it's definitely always a much more enriching experience to see the art in person. I mean, you talk about it in the class and look at it in the books, but sometimes you're surprised by the ones that are going to affect you in person, and the ones that maybe you thought would don't as much.
Yeah, that's true. I was in Dallas at the Dallas Museum of Art, and I saw some Rauschenbergs there, and they were... I must have read it in the books, but I didn't connect with how huge some of these multimedia pieces were that kind of were photo transfer multimedia, and they were enormous and... just fantastic.
Yeah. I'd love to see some Rothkos in person.
I am a big Rauschenberg fan.
Yeah. You love, you talked about some artists that you've loved for a while. Is there anyone pretty recently that you've discovered that has you kind of excited or interested in their work?
You know, I feel like I've been a bit out of touch with what's going on recently.
I mean, yeah, it can be hard, like, when you're not...
What's really new?
You should, I know you said you don't Pinterest much, but honestly, I find Pinterest a great way to just start collecting pieces of art that I love of artists, and then they make suggestions of like, oh, if you like this, maybe you'll like this person.
That's a good idea.
And I'm pretty engaged with looking at current artists all the time, just because I am in school, so that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. And then also with my tattoo career, I'm sort of constantly looking for inspiration. So I get really inspired by different tattoo artists who are doing really amazing illustrative things.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I know I just turned you on to Jeffrey Farmer a little bit.
Yeah, and I haven't seen his work in person, but I've enjoyed reading about him and hearing about him. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who puts a lot of thought.
But then he's been around for a while.
Yeah, because the show he just had at the Vancouver Art Gallery was a mid-career survey. So he has been around for a while. But I just became aware of him because of that show.
Yeah.
But really fun. And I definitely, going through that show and seeing all the installations and the clutter and the collections, and I thought you would totally like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because we both love collections, too.
Hoarding.
Hoarding.
Yeah.
But we're very neat. We don't hoard, but it's tempting.
It's not out of control.
It's not out of control.
It could be.
Easily.
I had to move my studio about a year ago, and that took me months to go through everything and get rid of some stuff and keep some stuff and sort it. But I actually really enjoyed it because I felt like it really brought home that when you have a studio and you like working with found objects too, you're really curating a collection of stuff. Like, I could never just throw it all away.
Well, that's kind of what farmers...
By the way, so about. If I get hit by a truck, you'll have to come and take it all. Okay. I don't want it going in the garbage.
I'll keep it in my basement suite.
Yeah.
Which is, speaking of my basement suite, it's like when I bring things home, my partner goes, okay, well, that's neat, but where are you going to put it?
Yeah. Well, my studio mate and I had a deal that if either one of us got, like I said, hit by a truck or bus, that the other one would come in and make sure that their stuff didn't all go to the dump, that it got given away to appropriate people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mom, if you die, I'll go through your stuff.
Okay.
Who would you want to collaborate with?
Actually, I've had this idea for years, and I'd like to do it, maybe write a grant application for it. And what I'd like to do is take, say, 3 or 4 or 5 of the cool arts artists and pair them up with a professional artist.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and they would work in pairs, and it would be their working process would be documented, and then they'd kind of work off each other.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it would be about the control and decision making in it and how that worked. Like, I think it would be really, really interesting.
Yeah, because that's what I thought immediately, is that there's some artists that are very particular or very, you know, controlled, like where the art is going, and that would be quite an experience for them.
They probably wouldn't be ideal candidates. No. I'd have to, and I mean, I do have some artists in mind that I think would really like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be a really, the end product would be really interesting, but also the process and documented. That really interests me, and then I would probably be one of the artists involved.
Do you have a particular cool artist that you would want to work with?
Maybe Scott.
I'm sure I've seen his work, because I've seen quite a bit of it.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that, but he'd be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great idea.
I know.
I think one day you and I should do a collaboration.
I was thinking we should have a family show. That's what I was thinking.
That's a good idea,
too. One day, do a family art show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we certainly all have a lot of artwork laying around. And do more new stuff, of course, but...
Yeah. You, me, and George,
there's
for
no,
sure.
There's no shortage of stuff to put in it. Yeah. No, I like that idea, Mom. I think we should make that happen one day.
Maybe we could even go to extended family for that. George could play his theremin.
Oh, yeah. Cool. I like it.
Okay, that wraps it up. And thank you very much for listening, as always. If you want to send me an email, please email us at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter @tipsyarchives. We'd love to hear from you. This is Rachel Leagy. Thanks for listening.